3 years ago, I purchased an item that would finally give me the chance to get back at my brothers and sisters for all those competitions I lost. This was it. A device that made me a winner, complete with a feature that enabled me to cheer on my opponents or to taunt them with the simple pressing of a button. I purchased a Fitbit. And I quickly friended some of my siblings on the Fitbit app and wasted no time jockeying with them for an impressive ranking on the scoreboard of daily footsteps. It was on. Now, it doesn't really matter that the sibling competitions of yesteryear that I lost never really happened outside of my own anxious mind. My childhood was not that dramatic or difficult. All I really did was grow up with six bright, creative, talented siblings, which means that for my entire life on this planet, I have lived alongside a passel of peers, and I have always harbored at least a little uncertainty about my own place in the crowd. So even though I never had any serious opponents or lost any real contests, it can be hard to shake the impulse to compete, the desire to stand out, the drive to win. And so Fitbit is great. It's a fun way to stick out in a crowd. I can win this time. I have an active lifestyle and a lot of flexibility. I'm a light sleeper, so 10,000 step walks in the wee hours of the morning, that's doable. I see clients in a home office on my own schedule and business plan. So if my step count is low, I can easily pull ahead at some point in the day. I've got this. And yet, alas, it turns out I'm mostly pulling even with everybody else on the Fitbit scoreboard, except maybe Caroline McCall, who leaves me in the dust often enough. But my older brother and I were about even. It's never been easy to best him at something. He's just good at stuff. And he's good. He's a good guy. So if I crush him with a step count, it's not like I really feel a thrill of victory. Fitbit lets you taunt your friends, but I can't really do that with family. It only works with a couple of friends who tease to show their love. All I would have to do is go to my brother's profile and press taunt, right? But I know the feeling of satisfaction would be empty. The main reason I can joke about this competitive spirit is that I know in my heart that I am okay, that there is nothing about me that truly sets me below my siblings or anyone else. When my uncle, my dad's brother, wrote the eulogy for my mother 20 years ago, he said that my mother understood that in the eye of God, there is no one among us who is greater nor one who is less. All my life I've known this, about my siblings and my parents, but most importantly about God. And so I share something resembling kinship with the good Pharisee we meet today in a disturbing little parable of Jesus. The Pharisee is in the temple, one of the more prominent places where God reveals mercy and justice. And the Pharisee knows that he is okay, that he participates in a tradition much larger than his own little life, and that tradition will never let him go. He knows he is okay, and so he doesn't do good works or lead an honorable life to justify himself before God. He just lives that way because that's what feels right. That's his culture. That's simply how the world makes sense for him. He does good works because his tradition has formed him into that kind of a person. His behavior naturally flows from his identity. That's why the people who first heard this parable were likely bothered by what happened next, when this good man decided to indulge himself with a contemptuous, self-satisfied, competitive attitude. He chose to set himself above his neighbor, rather than remember that the temple offers abundant grace to everyone, and that the whole point of being a good person is to share God's goodness with others. In Fitbit parlance, The Pharisee taunted the tax collector. The tax collector was a reprehensible person. More on that in a moment. But it is shocking to see a good guy act this way. For us to understand who the Pharisee is, it helps to see him in our own time and place. Pharisees are not always portrayed positively in the New Testament, but they really were the good guys. For us, the Pharisee is the parishioner we love and trust, our good friend, the sweet person we know who likes our stuff on Facebook and would never taunt us for falling behind on our Fitbit steps. The Pharisee for us is the open-minded Christian, the well-informed voter, the funny and dedicated coworker, the passionate activist for justice, the devout and prayerful churchgoer, the friendly and reliable neighbor, someone we immediately admire. And so his ugly self-congratulatory behavior in the temple, it strikes a false chord. It disrupts our expectations. But the tax collector, he's a lout. The tax collector is a bully, a crook, a greedy member of the moneyed class, a public official who puts on a good show, but everybody knows he's bent, that he can't be trusted. The tax collector pursues profit at the expense of everything else: environmental destruction, income inequality, tearing the fabric of community, trampling the public square, and betraying the public interest. The tax collector doesn't care about these things. He is one of the collaborators and sycophants and swindlers we despise. He voted for the other candidate, the candidate we can't stand. And so his presence in the temple is deeply unnerving. What will he do in there? In the time of Jesus, the Roman Empire was suspected of using and abusing the temple the way we would use a cash machine, a private bank for the haves to fleece the have-nots, and nobody could do anything to stop it. The tax collector's decision to use the temple for the reason it was intended, as a place of forgiveness and justice, it's almost impossible to believe. It is an astonishing surprise. But then, his mere presence in the temple is extraordinary all by itself. No one can enter the temple unless they are already ritually pure. So this scoundrel somehow managed to pull that off, just like the obviously righteous Pharisee. How did that happen? But that's how parables work. They are intended to startle and upset us. They are supposed to disrupt our expectations. Jesus is pushing us to understand what it really means to be faithful, what it really means to be a community of faith. In his idea of a community of faith, there is no good deed, no act of generosity, no pious prayer that can redeem or justify a person. The Pharisee was born in God's embrace, and his prayers should simply be one more way that he participates in something that has always been bigger than him. His actions should all be motivated by gratitude and a desire to lift up his neighbors, not compete with them. Likewise, in this community of faith, when a disreputable tax collector walks into the temple and asks for forgiveness, no judgment of ours or rap sheet of his crimes can stop God from welcoming him into the family. Our translation of this parable says that the tax collector returned home justified rather than the Pharisee, implying that the Pharisee was not justified. But there's a more accurate translation of this passage from scholar Amy Jo Levine. She translates it this way: Jesus said to them, "Descending to his house, this one, the tax collector, is justified alongside that one, not rather than, alongside. Both are held in God's graceful embrace." We gather here in this place, not the ancient temple in Jerusalem, but this temple of Christ's body. We gather here with our jumble of achievements and failures, gifts and weaknesses, glowing resumes and scandalous rap sheets. We come with strong hearts and we bear the deep scars of heartbreak. We bind up wounds, but we also inflict them on ourselves and those we love. We feel the joys and the triumphs, but also the sorrows and the terrors of our fragile lives in this restless and conflicted world. Many of us have learned how to perform in this culture with skill and grace, this culture of following Jesus. There may even be a few of us who have never known what it's like to be an outsider. But even the most pampered insider among us probably feels the dull anxiety of competition, the internal buzz of worry that I might not measure up, or the unattractive self-satisfaction of thinking, I've got this, this Christian thing, I'm crushing it, right? But that competition isn't real. We are not being ranked. Christ is revealed to us when we embrace one another around this table and break the bread that nourishes every living person, including and especially that neighbor we most fear and despise. In the eye of God, there is no one among us who is greater nor one who is less. Will you take your place in the circle? There is a fragrant gift of grace and nourishment here for you. And there's an open spot for you. It's right over here. It's between that perfect-looking, righteous person who makes you feel inadequate and that weaker, troublesome person who doesn't do anything half as well as you. Welcome home.